what I love is when owners of buildings choose to unbundle the rent or mortgage for the parking space from the rent or mortgage for the dwelling, for example, or the office or what have you. When these are unbundled into two separate transactions, then the consumer is able to see exactly how much that parking space reliance or the greater car dependence is costing in their rent. So if it's 20 or 30% of their rent number, let's just use that example. Someone who's $2,400 a month for their rent, if they receive two bills, one for $2,000 for the apartment and or $1,800, let's say, for the apartment, and one for $400 or $600 for the parking space, as they're writing their checks or swiping their credit cards or, you know, pressing the button on their app to pay, make that payment, they're reminded, wow, that's a lot of money every month I'm spending on that parking space. I wonder if we really need two cars or three cars. What if we had two? Look how much we would be saving.
I'm today accompanied by Victor Dover. You are considered to be one of the most innovative persons in relation to urban design. Could you please explain a bit about that? How is it that you came to become an urban designer, especially an innovative one?
Well, I was trained as an architect and actually began my career in exhibition design. And I, at the time, had no idea I would end up being an urban designer or a town planner. I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, which is a beautiful, historic, walkable place served by transit. I worked in Washington, D.C., and I took for granted, I think, during that beautiful time of living there, just how many comforts a city gives. But I was fascinated with the architecture of the city and so on. I moved to Miami in the mid-1980s, along with my business partner, Joseph Cole. We moved here at the same time. It was sort of as if we landed on another planet because of the extent to which Miami, having been largely built in the 20th century, was dependent on cars. And walkability, while it can be found in some stellar, exemplar places in greater Miami, was scarce. And I learned a lot. A few years later, I was asked about this by an old professor who was asking about the new urbanism. He said, well, Victor, how do you grow new urbanists? And I said, well, you steep them in Old Town Alexandria like a strong tea for a couple of years. And you have them live in a walkable, transit-served place in older American cities or Europe. And then you parachute them into the asphalt coating of South Florida, and you water them like a plant you just planted, and a new urbanist will grow out of that. The old saying is that necessity is the mother of invention. I think there's a very clear reason why the new urbanism emerged in Miami. And it was out of necessity. We realized that the city had hit the wall in terms of conventional suburban sprawl growth and needed to reconnect with its roots as a traditional city and grow that way, and we could have a better Miami. And I like to think now, 30 plus years later, we do. That's made a difference. So really, it was life experience that made me want to learn more about this. Sometime in the first year when Joe Cole and I lived in Miami, we were at the beginning of our careers, we had a discussion about what we wanted to do. You know, what do we want to do when we grow up? And we wanted to do the most relevant work we could do that would make the most difference. I think that's the goal every young person starting out on their professional journey should think about and try to do. And we realized that helping people visualize change before it occurs, which is another way to say town planning and urban design, would be good. We realized that it was something bigger than architecture, at least bigger than the architecture of the individual buildings. It was the architecture of neighborhoods or the architecture of community that we needed to affect. So we started learning about urban design. Elizabeth Plater-Zyberg and Jaime Correa and others taught us a lot that we didn't know from our academic backgrounds, but as Liz's students at the University of Miami, we added on to what we knew, and before we knew it, we were urban designers.
Interesting. The costs of the dependency towards cars that cities develop, especially after the Second World War in the US, which was an era in which you, especially you remarked quite a bit about this in your book, Street Design. It's a great book, really recommended read to everyone listening to this. And you remark how the dependency towards the cars was principally inbuilt in the US in the 20th century, as you mentioned. And I've noticed that the mechanics of the cost of car dependency are not as tangibly felt. It's a vicious cycle of higher dependency, which leads to people not noticing the costs, because you can always seemingly improve your situation by adding one lane more to the amount of lanes available for
driving farther from work to home to achieve a lower mortgage.
Yeah, exactly.
At the expense of all that extra cost in transportation. It is hidden. I think that's exactly right. You have to remember that what we were learning from Miami having lost its way in the middle of the 20th century wasn't just about car dependence. It was also about an attitude toward the city. The attitude was that turning your back on the public realm and focusing your home on its backyard was considered normal. And so there was an antisocial or isolation component built into suburban sprawl in the American Sunbelt and everywhere to which that model has been exported, unfortunately. And it's more than just car dependence. In fact, can you imagine going before consumers in the 1940s and 1950s and saying, I've got something for sale. I want to sell you car dependence. No one would put it that way, right? That isn't what they bought. What they bought, they thought, was car freedom. In fact, there was an old newsreel entitled To Ford Freedom, meaning that if your household had two fine Ford automobiles, not only would one spouse, probably the husband, be free to drive it to work in the morning and home in the evening, but the second spouse would be free to drive a second car. And originally that was sold as freedom for the housewife who was stuck at home and now could go see their friends or go shopping without waiting for the husband to bring the car home. But of course it opened the door to two-income households and both spouses working and driving to work. So it was the transformation was bigger than cars is what I'm trying to say. It was also an evolving attitude toward the city and changing households. So if you were attending the 1939 World's Fair and in New York, where they showcased the future, the General Motors exhibit was a famous kind of showcase of what the future would look like with a car for everyone, a car trip for everything you might need to do, and a dissolution of the city into the countryside. And it was sold quite enthusiastically. Your eyes, your ears for that exhibit, for that sell, that advertisement, were eyes and ears that had just experienced the Great Depression and were confronting grim things on the horizon, like the rise of fascism and the tragedies of the Second World War. So thinking about Tomorrowland, a place where you could drive freely anytime you wanted. You didn't have to wait for a train or a streetcar. You didn't have to go where they laid the tracks and told you. You had to go anywhere you want. That seemed like freedom, not dependence. Do you see? And so after the Second World War, when it was then implemented in a big way, and no longer just a theory, this gigantic experiment on the scale of a whole continent, then repeated around the world, it had no field test. There was never really an experimental version of car-dependent suburban sprawl. And all the financial systems that support it, it was just implemented everywhere and all at once. But your eyes were not the cynical eyes of today, where we look back on traffic jams and energy cost and climate change and other things as the result of those things, people thought they were buying freedom for their children to live in greener places. To veterans who had fought the war and returned, who had lived with the horror of the Second World War and the noise and the fury and violence of it, came home and wanted peace. They wanted quiet in their backyard. So you can understand why they adopted this model that was for sale with such enthusiasm. So I don't think we can blame the consumers exactly. They had to be convinced. There were lots of people who questioned it. Lewis Mumford was one of them. We quote him in our book, who said that the freedom to make every part of the city accessible to car was freedom to destroy the city. So there were people who figured that out. And there were others who, very early on in the experiment, as long ago as the early 1960s, with the Jane Jacobs publishing her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, there were people sounding the warning. This is not working. This model is broken. There was a beautiful tragicomic book published in the 1950s called The Crack in the Picture Window, which was all about picture window being a physical feature of the typical American suburban ranch house of the time, the big window in the front that showcased the world outside in the front yard and in the street. The crack in the picture window was an expose that these cities with identical houses or suburbs with identical houses and low density and driving everywhere for everything was actually a trap. That there was a crack in this vision, and the model was broken, and they warned us. But that didn't slow the experiment. I think what really began to change the appetite for car dependency came later. Say the 1973 oil embargo was a kind of warning that little changes in the world oil market could dramatically change your household costs, and was a good warning. And then, of course, quite a bit later, widespread understanding of the perils of climate change. But in the meantime, we had generations who had grown up stuck behind the car. And of course, many of the people who grew up in the suburban sprawl model want nothing to do with it now in adulthood. And it's actually one encouraging after effect of our symptom of our time is that the kids who grew up in the suburbs in the 1990s and early 2000s are now the adults who are saying, we must do something different. And while they don't face the violence of the Second World War, they face other things like the existential threat of climate change. And so all this is to say, I'm actually an optimist. I think with the young people who are coming into control and who are buying homes and starting businesses and building households and families now are demanding something quite different from their grandparents.
It's interesting to see how the empirical evidence, which was not gathered through trial and error in a decentralized manner after the Second World War during the 40s and the 50s in the US, has now in a harsh way, been proven at a nationwide scale because due to the centralized manner of the planning, which was implemented from a beginning. And that has led to all the costs, which we now see in the rates of heart disease, carbon emissions, the reduction in the density of population.
Childhood obesity, early onset diabetes, hypertension. We can name a lot of public health ills. There are also the financial problems, the great cost, $10,000 or more per year per car to maintain a fleet of, designed around single occupant car trips is inherently unaffordable. And therefore, people are struggling with student loan debt and the high cost of housing, and forgetting that a huge amount of their disposable income is being vacuumed up by their vehicle.
That's where free parking comes into the equation, doesn't it? It's like, in economics, there's a term called a tragedy of the commons, which means that what you individually perceive as being convenient for you is a tragedy at the level of the collective. And the exact same thing happens with both free parking and subsidies to all activities related to cars, like the construction of public ways through which the cars can move. All that cost not assumed directly by the user of the car is a subsidy to the total cost of the usage of the car. And what ends up happening is that you are going to end up paying, you want it or not, for a big part of the cost of using a car. So now you can either assume the rest of the cost of the using of the car or not, and you perceive the that extra, let's say, 40% of cost of using the car, because the 60% is mandated by the government through taxes. The perception, the individual perception of the options you have is much more positive towards the usage of cars. And this leads directly to the rabbit hole, the vicious cycle towards car dependency, which we were talking about before. And there's a paradox called the Downs-Thompson paradox, which I would like you to elaborate a bit about, which has a lot to do with the fact that the amount of load a way for transporting cars has is not as sensitive to the amount of lanes until the marginal benefit of using the public transport is tangible. Until using the public transport is not going to give you any benefit, adding lanes is not going to change anything. So you are only going to bankrupt yourself. Am I correct?
Well, I agree with everything you said. Let's take it apart one piece at a time. And while a lot of this is tragic or tragicomic, there's the ending of the story I want to hasten to say is positive, because the experiment has been running its course, and there is a way forward in the future in which we can transcend this trap. We can get out of the hole we've dug. So I want to make sure I put that out there first. I remain optimistic. Let's go all the way back to the tragedy of the commons. In the high point of American city planning, the period of the American Renaissance, when Daniel Burnham was designing the plan for Chicago, or John Nolan, the great first American to call himself a professional city planner, was also a great landscape architect, and the heir to the Olmsted traditions, they were practicing. And this was 1905 to 1925, let's say, 1929. In that period of time, Nolan and others made it their life's mission to prove that ourselves, in our brains, in our minds, in our consciousnesses, we could learn to balance the greater good and the needs of the whole habitat. They often use that word, but the whole system with their individual wants and desires, that there was a kind of balancing of these that was possible. So basically they sought to leverage consumer capitalism as a tool in proving that idea. And they were very successful. They designed many parts of what we now consider classic American cities, sometimes abroad, especially in Afro-Caribbean countries, and in Latin America. There were also broad experiments along these lines in the plans of Jean-Claude Nicolas Forestier, or in, say, Belle Epoque, Buenos Aires. They constructed as a consumer product and for sale things, big portions of what are now considered the historic classic cities. But it was business that did it, and they did it for profit, and they did it with a combination of central planning that you described and individual effort and freedom. And so we had a period of time, really the first half of the 20th century in the United States, when growth and change were actually making things better in cities, not worse. They were actually overcoming challenges and ills of the early industrial city, which was toxic to people. And they were building their way out of their problems. In the City Beautiful, in the Garden City, I think there was a kind of reconciling of these individual needs and wants and desires and the greater good and nature, that we could actually harmonize nature and our needs as individuals. And I think we've lost touch with that in the middle of the 20th century. Now we have so before Tony Downs came out with that theorem that said adding lanes is just going to induce more traffic. Now that's all. There's a whole science built around the idea of induced travel demand. It was already clear to people like Robert Moses, who was busy building highways, which were paid for by tolls at the toll booth, that when they added more bridges or added more lanes or more toll booths to the bridges, that they would induce more travel demand, more latent driving, and people would drive farther. And the historical research now makes it pretty clear, even Moses knew clearly that he was making the problem worse, not better. But it was also thrusting more coins into the toll booth collection box, and more money was coming into his power. So he kept right on doing what he was doing right into the 1970s. So the induced travel demand, as defined by Downs later, was already known to people like who were in the middle of it, like Moses in the 1940s. So now we have a situation in which you can't widen the roads fast enough to keep up with the demand that will accumulate to get them. And it isn't just because more people are driving or driving more often. It's also because they're lengthening their trips. We took what used to be a short trip to a neighborhood hardware store and replaced it with a long trip to a big box home improvement store. So now a trip that might have been a couple of miles is now a 10-mile trip or a 20-mile round trip. So all those extra vehicle miles traveled are adding to the number of people who are in a lane of traffic in front of you when you're in your car and trying to get somewhere. And this is where the great delegation, as Recall calls it, of responsibility for deciding the timing and path of your travel backfired. The perception was that we were going from having you confined to going only with having freedom, only to go where you could walk, or to the places where the operators of the streetcar lines and the trains wanted you to go. And you could only go there when they wanted you to go because of the timing of the streetcars or the trains. The Great Delegation, which was sold by General Motors and Firestone Tires and Standard Oil companies and others, was we're going to take that decision-making responsibility away from the central planners and operators of the transit systems and give it to you individually as consumers. You decide when to pull the car keys out of your pocket and put it into the ignition and drive your car when and where you want to. And at first it sounds like freedom. Okay, that's the mystery of it. It turns out it's not free at all. First of all, it isn't without cost, because it's very costly, that inefficient trip. Your demand for space to make a single occupant car trip is so vast that you are basically grabbing a bigger chunk of the habitat for yourself and leaving less available for your neighbors. If your house makes 10 or 12 or 14 car trips per day per household, then you need 14 or 28 or 36 parking spaces waiting for you all around town in case you might decide to go there. Okay? And you take up so much space driving by yourself in a car in a lane of traffic that there's no way we can ever catch up with the inefficiency of that model. So traffic congestion mounts and people are frustrated. And so I believe we've begun in many places in the United States to hit the wall with that model, because the first few generations of car users during the golden age of the automobile felt they had what traffic engineers call the free-flowing condition, often enough that it was worth putting up with the hassles or the costs. There were little warnings like the protests of Mumford or the spiking costs that came with the 1973 oil embargoes. But those were offset by the sense of liberty that it was giving to people, of course, at the expense of others and their habitat. However, the people who grew up in cars and in car-dependent suburbs during the last 30 years or so have no such delusions of freedom or comfort or happiness. They're frustrated. We have, for 30 years, we've seen a decline in the number of people who have a driver's license that are aged between age 16 and age 25. It's been dropping down every year. And then about 10 or 12 years ago, that number fell off a cliff. And the number of 16-year-olds that were going on their birthday to go get a driver's license dropped dramatically, and it stayed down, and it's leveled off. What does this tell you? Is that that old association, that if I can just get old enough to drive my own car, I'll have freedom, has been replaced with an association that goes like this. Have a car? Where am I going to park it? How much is that going to cost? How much are tires and gas and insurance? How am I going to pay for that when I'm also paying for student loans or what have you? Or wages have been stagnant while rents have rising. So the associations now are not positive with cars. Many, many young people growing up still go get their driver's license. But the old days of the free-flowing condition and the sense of freedom and elbow room that a car might give have been replaced with the feeling of being cramped by that. And so what are people doing? They're buying bikes. For several years, we've seen the rate of purchase of new bicycles exceed the rate of purchase of cars. And that's been just rising and rising faster and faster. They're living in cities. If they can find a space that's affordable to them, they're living with less square footage and or square meters in their apartment, living closer to other people, but getting city comforts in return, including not having to use a car for everything. So I think we've actually turned a really important historical corner. As eras go, the car era will be looked on by history as a short one.
If we think of it from an engineering perspective, a liter of gasoline has about 8,000 calories. And the amount of calories that the average person requires in Europe is about 2,500. So it's about four times more than the total expenditure of calories a person requires in a single day. And a liter of gasoline is not what you're going to use in a single day by your car. Your car uses considerably more. So just looking at the amount of calories consumed lets you notice the differences in orders of magnitude of consumption of resources that you are having while using a huge metal box that is surrounding you to move you at speeds which you are not evolved to move at. So that's why people get killed driving a car, because you're not supposed to be moving at 50 miles per hour.
Great point. But let's remember that in congestion, you're often moving much more slowly. So you might think you're going to make a 50 mile per hour trip. And what really happens is you get to go 40 or 50 miles an hour for a few seconds until you slam on the brakes and screech to a halt at the just short of the taillights of the car in front of you, because traffic will move very slowly. So you might think you're going to make a fast trip and your average speed is actually still only 12 or 15 miles per hour. The speed you could probably attain on a bike at peak hour in many, many markets. In Atlanta or Los Angeles or Houston and Dallas or Miami, we move very slowly at peak hour when we choose to drive.
Yeah, and that's because the amount of congestion, the speed at which you move is not linear to the amount of cars moving through a lane. It is exponentially slower as you add one car, and that car marginally reduces the speed at which everyone moves considerably more than the previous one. And that phenomenon should be taken into account at the moment of making people assuming the cost of driving. I in the same way that parking lots should be paid for. And
you're speaking my language, Alex. I love your point, and it's absolutely correct. In fact, traffic engineers know this to be true as well. We often point out when we're arguing for a lane reduction or a lane repurposing or the narrowing of a lane or the slowing of the pace of the cars in a given corridor, we point to a thing that's in the traffic engineer's own handbooks called the speed flow capacity diagram. No, this is really geeky and nerdy, but bear with me. It sounds like your audience can tolerate it. So, and you and I are into it. So what does the speed flow capacity diagram tell us? That at 25 miles per hour or 26, you're getting about as many cars through a lane of traffic as you will ever get. And as you continue to speed up, the number of cars you can get through that lane of traffic actually diminishes per hour instead of going up. So why design the transportation system for an inherent inefficiency around speed? It's illogical. It's as illogical as free parking, which I know you asked about. I want to connect the dots between the first part of what you said about the tragedy of the commons and the free parking space, because the idea of free parking, that was invented. I mean, people were, you know, paying a livery stable to board their horse when they decided to get to step off their off the saddle of their transportation mode. They paid someone to keep their horse, right? So the idea that we just park our cars and walk away and expect that space to be provided for to us for free is false. Someone is actually paying for it, and the someone is you. As the old cartoon says, we have met the enemy and he is us. But the cost is embedded in the cost of the goods you were buying at the store when you parked in the retail parking lot, or in the cost of the rent for the apartment when you parked in the parking lot down below, downstairs. So these costs are kind of hidden. It's not really free. It's not free at all. And then what we have the shared parking supply that belongs to all of us, whether it's on street parking or in municipal public infrastructure. And many cities are hesitant to charge what that's really costing them, both in opportunity and in physical real estate. And so the smarter cities are now weaning themselves off of the drug of free parking. My line is that parking is like a narcotic and should be a controlled substance, because as we become hooked on it, we want more and more of it. And we to get our fix, we're willing to destroy our communities to get more of it. That's how tragic it is. And the people who vend it, who are selling it, are just like the drug dealer. They know you're hooked. They want to sell you a little more. In this case, it's a little indirect, because that vendor is probably providing it to you as a result of the requirements in your local land development regulations. So government is forcing the retail store to sell you that parking space for a fake free. And the government is forcing that apartment building to provide those parking spaces for its tenants. And all they're doing is just forcing our dependence on the drug to grow worse. So that said, hundreds of cities have picked up on this as a result of economist and planner Don Shoup writing so vividly about the fallacy of all this, that they're repealing their minimum parking requirements. And that is progress. I told you I'm optimistic at the end and things are actually getting better. What a great indicator that that is true. To see zoning bodies who enthusiastically adopted minimum parking requirements a generation ago, now enthusiastically repealing them.
Yeah, free parking does not exist. It's an incoherent concept. The first lesson you learn in economics is that nothing is free. You always pay for it. It's either you who pays for it or someone else, but someone will pay for it. And in the case of parking, it's not even someone else. It's you who pays for it. But the mechanics of the payment is unconditional. No matter whether you go to the city center with your car and you use that spot, you're still going to pay for it. So you rather would use it than not, because you feel like you are having access to a resource which you are not exploiting if you do not exploit. And that's where the tragedy, another tragedy of the commons, occurs here, which the price of parking, it's absurdly set at zero when it shouldn't be. Zero is never or almost never a good price.
Actually, a friend of mine put it this way. If you decided you wanted to place your furniture in the parking space out on the street, and you want to put others of your belongings, your dog's kennel and your spare lumber or your wood pile for your fireplace, you just decided to start piling those up in the middle of the street, someone would say, hey, why are we taking this valuable public real estate and giving that to you for free to store your stuff? And yet we store our cars in it, in that same real estate, and don't question it. And so I think you're absolutely right. You know, you called it a vicious cycle. I actually think we might call it a self-reinforcing system, because it has many components. And that system includes the financial models under which we obtain loans or mortgages or credit or subsidy. It includes the regulatory regime, which doesn't just mandate, you know, minimum parking requirements. There's all sorts of other things, like mandating low densities and mandating that each land use should be separated from the others by maximum distances, mandating car trips, of course, in between each of them, thus reinforcing the system. And it goes on. Those same regulations mandate that we push the buildings farther apart from each other with setbacks. Might have started with good intentions about controlling fires or toxicity, but now it's just a way of making a suburban enclave more exclusive for people who can afford the higher price. Often people who are not just wealthier, but wider, you know, so we can travel down that road and find injustice at every turn. The self-reinforcing system includes the vendors themselves. Every technical expert, from the architect, the engineer, the landscape architect, the planner, and every, and especially the traffic engineers, they're all in it and benefiting from reinforcing the system, doing more of what they're used to doing inexpensively. And so I've just condemned government at several levels and the operators of public infrastructure, condemned the professional industries, and I'm also condemning the developers, because when a model is easy to do, developers build more of it. If it's subsidized, and those hidden subsidies can be skimmed off as profits to the merchant builder or national production builder or developer, they will. So they're in it as well. And then last in this constellation of components in the self-reinforcing system, us as individuals choosing to do things we know harm us. Now, people choose to smoke cigarettes that harm them. They choose to get drunk, even though they know that's bad for their brain cells. Human beings choose a lot of things that are bad for them. There's nothing new about that. But when it comes to the way we construct the world and the things we buy from the people who construct it for us, this whole system will only begin to correct itself when the consumers show a preference for things that are built the right way and have a better self-reinforcing system. So let's turn that around. As Gabe Klein says, people will use the infrastructure that you build. So if you build highways and parking lots, they drive. And if you build bike lanes and transit systems and sidewalks, what do? They walk and they bike and they use transit. So first of all, we do have to make that shift. We have to take much larger amounts of the taxpayer money that are invested in mobility, have them invested in walking, biking, and transit. There's no question that's where it has to happen. We as consumers, we reinforce that when we choose, if we can afford it, a neighborhood that has those features, provides all the other interesting city comforts, like the ability to walk from your desk at lunchtime and grab a meal without having to drive a car to a fast food restaurant to do it, or meet your friend, walk from your front porch or your front stoop of your home to meet a friend for dinner within walking distance of your home. Those are things we can do that will reinforce the system in a positive way. Now, if it costs so much money to build highways and parking spaces, and it takes so much land, and it has so little return on investment and more headaches than benefit, it's amazing that we continue to spend billions of dollars every year doing more of the thing that's hurting us and simultaneously helping us choke the planet, right? So on the other hand, investment in bike infrastructure, huge return on investment, very low cost, and behavior changes are amazing. Public health officials have told us that if you live within a mile of a class one bikeway, which is to say a bike path or trail that is separated from traffic. So class one bikeway is one where you're not just in a striped bike lane next to the fast-moving cars, but you're in a relatively safe, high-quality bike infrastructure. So if you live within a mile of one of these Class 1 bikeways, you are 15% more likely to get your recommended daily exercise. Now, that may sound like a small number, 15%, 15% more likely. No, that's a huge number. If given these epidemics of giant proportions of public health, and in those I will include the ones we've mentioned, like early onset diabetes and childhood obesity and hypertension, heart disease. If public health officials and epidemiologists and doctors and insurance companies could figure out a way to get 15% more of the people to get their recommended daily exercise, that is worth trillions of dollars wasted personally and collectively on healthcare. It's a vast amount of money saved, not to mention lives and quality of life. So that's enormous.
Isn't something incredibly analogous to what happens in the subsidy of using your car by the government and its regulations occurring at the level of healthcare? Because the users only pay for about 10% of the total cost for healthcare. And then 45% is paid by insurance, and then for another 45% is paid by the government. So you don't really see a lot of the direct cost of what you are spending, of what you are consuming, but you actually are generating a huge cost.
Well, these percentages do vary by country. And I will say that in our country, we have an inordinately expensive relative to its effectiveness system for healthcare. So I don't want to use a broad brush here and say this is the same for everyone, because there are clearly other models, as we see in Canada and so forth. So there, but if you set aside who's paying for just a moment and look at what it's the money's being spent on, what you see is that we shouldn't really refer to this as healthcare. Or even in Britain, I've heard leaders say they don't think it should be called a national health system, because health is not what they're selling. What they're selling is repair. You know, they're in the sickness repair business, not the wellness business. So if you could think about it like this, investments made in the physical environment that improve the physical determinants of public health, and the payoff is not in just in savings of money that would otherwise be spent trying to repair someone's heart disease or what have you. It's actually a gain. We're doing more than just simply delaying or avoiding repair cost, which is most of what our healthcare system is focused on. We're actually improving quality of life and longevity and you know, on the front end. So we're buying goodness, not just fixing or trying to fix badness. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
We are just being less bad when we say pedal to work instead of driving to work. We're being more good. And of course, up till now, there have been very few rewards for that, at least in the U.S. I would say that's less true in other countries. But in the U.S., the person who opts to bike to work is probably punished with a stressful experience amid the violence and hostility of traffic on the mean and slightly dangerous streets. But we can definitely see from the Dutch and Danish experiments, just to name a couple, and from other experiments like the ones underway now in Paris and London, that if we reward the person who is on 2 feet or 2 wheels instead of 4 wheels with a good experience, they'll do more of it. So now we've moved into a new form of self-reinforcing system, a good one.
Yeah, I would like to push back a bit on the analogy you drew between opioids and free parking. I think that in the case of opioids, the government is not subsidizing the consumption of the substance. And what makes it attractive is the benefit you derive from it. But the market is self-limiting in the consumption of opioids, in the sense that you assume all the cost and all the benefit of the transaction. I'm quite liberal in relation to the consumption of drugs. I think the individual should be the responsible who decides whether to consume it or not. So I would not advocate for regulation in terms of drug consumption. And I think something similar would have to occur at the level of parking. Parking should, in my opinion, be something that the business or the owner of the terrain decides whether to supply it or not.
Of course, you're right. You know, I appreciate your pushback. It's you're not wrong. A couple of things I would add to that. First, repealing minimum parking requirements is simply deciding to let the market make the choice. And so that's more in tune with what you're saying. We are saying that the owner of that terrain can make the decision about what their market requires. Now, let's remember, we are trying to fix something that is badly broken. So we have a remedial step to take here, where in some cases, the remedies are peeling back asphalt and replacing it with green or with development sites. And in some cases, the remedies are making a correction for an overprovision of subsidized free parking. So repealing minimum parking requirements is a huge step. And what that does is now it gives back to the property owner or the tenant or the user of the parking space the decision about whether to pay for them or not. So what I love is when owners of buildings choose to unbundle the rent or mortgage for the parking space from the rent or mortgage for the dwelling, for example, or the office or what have you. When these are unbundled into two separate transactions, then the consumer is able to see exactly how much that parking space reliance or the greater car dependence is costing in their rent. So if it's 20 or 30% of their rent number, let's just use that example. Someone who's $2,400 a month for their rent, if they receive two bills, one for $2,000 for the apartment and or $1,800, let's say, for the apartment, and one for $400 or $600 for the parking space, as they're writing their checks or swiping their credit cards or, you know, pressing the button on their app to make that payment, they're reminded, wow, that's a lot of money every month I'm spending on that parking space. I wonder if we really need two cars or three cars. What if we had two? Look how much we would be saving. So you're right that we don't literally have to make it a controlled substance to have a powerful market-based effect. And I'm there with you 100%. Now, there are communities that are adopting maximum parking requirements, which is getting back into regulating it. And maybe that is a little bit like putting brakes on the free administration of controlled substances, isn't it? So in the case of the opioids, the legally prescribed opioids are part of the epidemic. The doctors, the hospitals, the insurance companies, and of course the drug manufacturers and the taxpayers are all in on it. We have scandals that routinely make their way under the headlines about so-called pill mills, where doctors are freely prescribing the opioids to people who don't really need them or will be harmed by them, but they get a big paycheck from doing that. And that is appalling, right? And so, for good reason, government cracks down on that. But I think we need to look at the parking system as being similar to medicine in this way. Prescribed in the right doses and used as directed by your physician, and taken at appropriate intervals, not overdoses, then this medicine can be good for you. But consumed in a uncontrolled way and without being used as directed and without the supervision of someone who has some idea how much harm it might do to you, I think parking is a lot like that. We overprescribe it. And you know the numbers have been getting better. In the 1970s, the number of parking spaces expected for a retail shopping center, for example, was much higher than the number that is expected now. We've actually made progress on that front. So maybe the just loosening it up a little on the regulation and letting the market decide is a good thing. And I'll give you one last example. We have, and I'll mention car share, ride share services, Uber and Lyft, at the risk of opening up another can of worms. And I'll just, here, what I'm going to tell you is about hotels. When I was in planning school, we learned, and in all the old zoning documents, you learn, and it's reinforced, that urban hotel rooms need parking spaces. So you count up the number of hotel rooms, and then you apply a factor to it. You know, and the rule books would all say, thou shalt have 0.75 parking spaces per hotel room, 75 parking spaces per 100 hotel rooms. And then if you had ballrooms in your hotel and you had meeting spaces and conference rooms in a restaurant and so on in your hotel, you would need even more parking. You might need like 1 or 1.25 parking spaces per hotel room. And that's just everybody knew. That's how many you have to do. And you can look at our country and see, here's the big hotel, and here's the big hotel parking lot, and here's the next big hotel, and here's the next big hotel parking lot. It's a clear, vivid, graphic illustration of the rule. But guess what? In the last 4 or 5 years, 5 or 6 years, I can say now, the number of urban parking spaces actually demanded at a hotel has been dropping really rapidly. And that's because of Uber and Lyft. Business people used to arrive in a city, go to the rental car counter, rent a car, drive into town or to their meeting or what have you, end up at their hotel and park their car. And they were justifying the old rule that about 75 out of every 100 of you are going to have a car with you and we need to store it. But now those same business people are arriving at the airport and stepping out onto the curb, their app in their hand, and getting into a rideshare vehicle. And they're getting dropped off at their meeting or at their hotel, and the Uber or Lyft driver drives away. And you don't worry anymore about where that car is being parked. So as a result, do you want to guess how many parking spaces are being demanded per hotel room by the market?
50%, what the regulator said.
Less. 30 out of every 100 hotel guests in an urban hotel are now asking for and expecting to use a parking space.
Oh, wow.
0.3, and it's dropping. It's going down. So it'll keep going down until it hits some level. So isn't that interesting? What we are telling you is that the rule books are designed as if the market doesn't change or technology doesn't change or habits among consumers don't change, but they do change. And that's why it's a bad way to design city to do planning by the numbers.
Donald Shoup eloquently described this phenomenon in his book, The High Cost of Free Parking, in which he talked about the absurdity of the process of getting into a number of how many parking lots should be had per square meter of a building, or by any random arbitrary variable that you can think of, there's a number. And urban designers copy each other, and they do not question whether that's a rational number. And when studies have been conducted showing where, or asking the urban designers where they got their numbers from, they all converge into a random study done like 1,000 years ago, which was nonsense. And people seem to just copy each other, because if you get found out to just copy something arbitrarily, you can always say, oh, but this other guy also does it. Are you going to fight them and me? You're not, so leave me alone.
Right. So what is the path out of the wilderness? The path out of the wilderness is the desire for a better life. You know, people want the city, want comforts. They want to enjoy the wonders of life, and many of them want to come together in cities because we're social beings. Now, that doesn't mean everybody. Some people want to go off and be by themselves. I remain optimistic because I think the old appetite for sprawl and for a car-dependent lifestyle has diminished. It may still be there among older generations. That's important to remember, because folks from those older generations tend to have time to come out to public meetings and complain about zoning reforms and so on. So that's a risk. But for, you know, at least 2 or 3 younger generations of adult Americans, we now see a different set of appetites. You know, they want to be with their friends. They want to be where there's caffeine. They want to be there where there's music. And they want to be where they can meet other people. And they don't necessarily want to spend an hour or 90 minutes a day in a car or more than that. So there, while there still are people who are doing that, a great many of the folks in the market are now preferring the traditional walkable neighborhoods of the old city. There just aren't enough of them to go around. And that means that the way out of the wilderness is to as we build and rebuild, to build more of those walkable, compact, complete, connected communities. And because, you know, consumers clearly prefer it, they'll even pay extra for it. It's a value creating thing that saves money, costs less to build, and has more benefits, not just the healthcare benefits that we talked about before, but more daily life benefits and more tax-based benefits, for example, for municipalities that have to pay the bills. So I think the way out of the wilderness is to build our way out of our problems. We don't have enough housing. Well, let's build some more, but let's build it in the format that today's consumers need, not the folks from a 1950s situation comedy.
Yeah, without even looking at the healthcare benefits that you would derive from transitioning away from car dependency. There's a great YouTube channel called Not Just Bikes, which I'm a huge fan of. And one of the episodes talks about the income or the public funds created by different regions on different cities. And Houston happens to have a huge drain of resources due to the huge lanes that they have constructed. And then there was a comparison with Amsterdam, which is probably one of the most civilized cities in the world. And the amount of income that the government generates out of a region depends highly on the density of the population and the size of the city. If things are designed for humans, things will be comfortable for them and people will do human things. But if things are done for...
It's this last point.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't just guarantee results or success by upping the density. You also must improve the designs. Michael Koval Anderson, my friend, calls it the life-sized city, which is a nice way of thinking about it. Carlos Moreno talking about the 15-minute city in which the needs of daily life are accessible within a radius. These are examples of that idea. But there's more to it than that. The individual building-to-street relationship at the level of a single work of architecture is also one of the design determinants. For example, we don't like to walk by a blank wall. As human beings, it's not how we evolved. It's against our nature. That's a street we would rather not walk on. We don't like to walk down a street that lacks shade or enclosure, because we have evolved as a species to prefer that sense of spatial enclosure and comfort that comes from the street feeling like a public room. So if you face that public room with front porches and storefronts and balconies and windows and doors and people coming and going, and you equip it with buildings and trees that provide shade, then this is a street we're likely to want to walk on. And so the little decisions, the tiny decisions, almost atomized decisions that we make about an individual building and its storefront or its stoop or its front porch, or an individual block on a street corridor, those little decisions add up to whether this is a place where we will remain more car dependent or a place where we'll actually prefer to walk and or bike and or use transit. And if we drive, make short trips rather than long ones. I don't want to leave the short trips driven by car out, because I think that will remain part of the mix, as will deliveries and, you know, cargo bikes and just lots of things other than the traditional images that come to mind when I say walking and biking and transit. That is the way out. And so the Dutch cities have proven, I think, pretty vividly, and of course, people from all over the world travel to see Amsterdam and the Netherlands, or to see Copenhagen and Denmark, and they come back with those lessons, and they're, to whatever degree, trying to apply them in some way. So what do they find? Well, it depends. In some locations, we have an immediate backlash against these things. There is definitely pushback against bike infrastructure in many municipalities. People are confused and don't really understand how it benefits them. And maybe they're a little frightened of change. It's interesting, you know, saying we don't want to do something because that's not the way we always did it is a normal human reaction. Perhaps even more so in America, where we get in the habit of doing something now and we want to instinctively keep doing it the way we have been doing it. And yet tradition, in the fuller sense, is a key to solving these design puzzles, because we don't have to invent that build industry relationship that we know will produce privacy within the dwelling unit and happiness for the pedestrian outside on the street. We know how to do that. And it's, in fact, traditional. It's the way we always did it, at least in the U.S. from colonial times until the 1940s. And so in one way, we need to reconnect with traditions that actually work and discard old habits that don't. And I think distinguishing between the two is important, because there are things that we don't have to figure out from scratch. And I will say, in architecture, a lot of the material is understood. You know, building, the street, relationships, proportions, materials. It's easy to replicate success if we just let ourselves do it.
Hunter-gatherers were not bulldozing cities for steel boxes.
Well, that's right. And, you know, some of each is are still going on. You know, we are repairing in one province and destroying in another. And so change isn't adopted evenly. You know, change is adopted experimentally. If you think of the city as a form of evolution, then what's evolution? Experimentation, mutations that work and then therefore get repeated. Things that prove to work. And, you know, there are some pretty reliable things that, having experimented with them enough times, we don't have to guess what they are. We know that a city that is a place that showcases tolerance instead of intolerance, a city that encourages small business and not just big business, a city that encourages walking, biking, and transit, short car trips, as opposed to will succeed. When all of those things will attract people and lead to success. And we also know that continuing to build big highways because we think wider and faster roads are better roads is just going to prove Tony Downs correct with every test. And so while those continue, because that's the way they've been used to doing it, the mutations are proving far more successful than those habits.
The centralized trial and error shows the superiority of cycling, walking, and public transport in comparison to the dependency towards cars.
Right, but we can trust the market on this because the real estate values are higher in that walkable, transit-served, bike-friendly space. The sales in the retail shops and restaurants are higher in the place that welcomes people to arrive through all four means instead of just one. And you know, the cost of delivering municipal services, whether it's delivered in a pipe like water and sewer, or in a wire like telecommunications or power, or in a police car or a school bus, the cost of delivering those municipal services goes down in the place where the real estate value is going up. You know, it's just a matter of watching it unfold. We went through a period, remember, 50 years of experiment, maybe more, of experimentation before the lessons began to be apparent. And then we've continued for another 40 years with that experiment as the lessons accumulate. And so now we have a situation in which, at least here in North America, people are conditioned to be suspicious of growth and change. They think growth and change is going to make things worse rather than better. And that is unprecedented. If you think of the history of the world, growth and change in a community was the key to unlocking wealth for individuals and households and businesses and institutions. Growth and change were beneficial. It's only very recently in the sprawl experiment in the middle of the 20th century where we became accustomed to a form of growth that was making things worse rather than better. That's new, and it can't last. We have to restore confidence.
Yeah, the decentralized manner at which the positive outcomes, like in a Darwinian sense, the thing that proves to be correct gets reproduced and is able to emerge out of the obscure, not being known by population, that lets to be known by all the people, and people can use that design, and then people can know more of it, and everything improves. So let's connect this knowledge we have about how cities which are at the level of humans or designed for humans are better than cities which are designed for cars with curb parking.
Great example. Along the curb, next to our sidewalks or pavements, that's a space that we trust local government to manage. And they might fit for curb parking, which might be free or you might charge for it. You can also use it as a loading zone or a rideshare pickup and drop-off area. You might decide to use the whole space on one side of the street for a bike facility, like an above-the-curb cycle track. You know, a high comfort, high safety, low stress bike facility. We might use it for a row of trees or use it for cafe space. So there are lots of ways to use that space along the curb. And again, the experiment in the 20th century was with assuming that that was the car domain and could only be used for that. And so often when it's proposed to repurpose that space, there's pushback or controversy. And right now in many cities, they're debating whether the spaces along what were on-street parking spaces, whether that space that was repurposed briefly during the pandemic lockdown for outdoor dining or cafe seating should remain in that or should return to car space, car storage space. So it's very interesting to watch that unfold. But I think microcosm of the bigger question, like how shall all our space thought about more carefully, including the rural and agricultural lands and the wilderness. Those spaces too are the subject of an ongoing economic debate.
And how are dynamical prices responding to the amount of demand in relation to the cars which want to park optimal in establishing the amount of occupancy at 85%? Why is 85% the optimal number?
Well, that's Don Shoup's number that he derived through a lot of research. And Professor Shoup is a great source and is careful in his work. So I assume it's probably right. But maybe the number is 80 or 90 or 86%. It doesn't matter exactly what the number is. Here's what's important. Some spaces always remain available. And if you dynamically price the on-street parking spaces, or you know, for that matter, all the parking spaces that are part of a shared municipal supply. So these could be parking spaces in a public parking structure or a parking lot. But let's just stick with the ones along the street. If you dynamically price those so that as demand rises, you charge more, then you're leveraging the fundamental law of supply and demand for community benefit so that there will always be a parking space available. And let's remember, deciding to drive there was a choice you made, and you don't get away with offloading the costs of that choice onto all the rest of society without paying for it. Under dynamic pricing, you pay a little more for it when it is scarcest and most in demand. So the reason for 15% remaining open is just to make sure that there always is a space available for someone who truly needs it and is able to pay for it. And now we've forgotten that the world is not just for people who own their own personal automobile or lease their own personal automobile and store it 24 hours a day somewhere in their driveway or in a parking lot or at work or what have you. But the world also consists of people who occasionally use cars. People who are renting a car, for example, for the day when they need to make a trip. Or people who almost never use a car because they walk or bike or use transit. But once in a while, they might want to rent a car to take a trip into the countryside or to go to a store that's only reachable by car, to load up on something that's only transportable by car. And so I think there are some other experiments that can run in parallel to the dynamic pricing. For example, what about changing the way we insure individuals? So if you drive less, you don't pay as much. That has always been part of the formula, but it was always, you know, a question of do you drive 15,000 miles per year or 20,000 miles per year? You could get a little discount if you drive less. But now we have people who are only driving when they really need to, and the rest of the time they're walking and biking and using transit. So why should their insurance be as costly as someone who drives 10 or 15,000 miles per year? It should not be. We should reward them, in fact, for their good behavior, for the benefit they're having to resolving the planetary carbon crisis, or to the benefit they're having for the public health crisis, or the epidemic of loneliness. There are all these reasons why we should be rewarding them. What other experiments could parallel the dynamic pricing? Well, what about an apartment building, for example, an apartment complex that chooses to have a small fleet, probably electrified cars that are available to the occupants of its building, not like a citywide car share program like Car2Go or Zipcar, but a building specific one. You know, the 200 units in this building have shared access to the 20 cars downstairs, and they can reserve them via the app. And they pay, you know, a little bit for the privilege, and they pay a little more per mile when they use it. And the rest of the time, that car is available to the other 199 occupants of that building. Well, that's similar to the dynamic pricing, isn't it? But on the supply side of the vehicle itself, instead of just the storage of it. So I love the idea that if we could get more of these experiments running in parallel, lower insurance, fleet sharing, we'll call it, ride share, mode split with walking, biking, and transit, and all of the other kinds of micromobility, like scooters and one wheel and what have you, and dynamic pricing, then now we've got another self-reinforcing system.
Exactly. Insurance companies are a huge nudge towards virtue when they are able to distinguish between good users of their services and bad users. But when you are not able to discern between people because the variable of kilometers driven per year is not taken into account, you make everyone pay the same when they are not as prone to having an accident.
I should say, while I'm optimistic and while there are good experiments underway, these positive mutations that will eventually become permanent, there are also still ridiculous investments being made in things we know don't work. For example, to get a new infrastructure bill passed in the United States Congress and signed by the president, with the largest unprecedented amount of money being spent on walking, biking, and transit, we also had to accept an even more tremendous number of billions of dollars that will be spent on things we know hurt rather than help, that are reinforcing car dependence. So that's not good. Instead of watching the proportion of money spent for walking, biking, and transit grow much larger, like as if we were actually trying to make a difference, the dollars might be bigger, but the scope of the effort is not proportionally expanding fast enough to keep up with the dumb old school development or infrastructure that's in the same bill. So that's a mistake. And then we have electrification of the fleet. I'm all for it. I think it's great. We should be shifting over to electric vehicles. No question. But it's sold as if that's the solution, when in fact the electric cars take up just as much space and they're just as inefficient to operate in space as the petroleum-fueled cars. And the electrification of the car fleet might only give people good feelings about continuing to do the wrong thing too much. And so that's unhelpful. Automation kind of follows the same track. It says, why don't we use automated or semi-automated vehicles so that we can just continue business as usual? And I'm discouraged by that. We should be using automation to increase safety, because we've decided as a culture that safety is a higher priority than congestion management or free flow. And that's really the decision we have to make.
Victor, I really enjoyed having this really insightful conversation with you. I know you've written a great book called Street Design, The Secrets to Great Cities and Towns. I will leave a link to that book on the description.
Great. And watch for the second edition next year. We'll have a new full color paperback edition with 100 more pictures and 100 more pages and new case studies and revision throughout. So I think people will enjoy the second edition of the Street Design book a lot. John Massengale and Robin Crowder and I have been working really hard on it.
You also have a personal webpage at dovercolne.com. and I will leave a link also to that. Where else can people find more about you?
Well, we found lots of people find the YouTube channel interesting. So I'll just say it's the Dover Cole YouTube channel. Cole is K-O-H-L. Take a look and see if you find some of the videos that are there useful, and subscribe or leave us a comment. That'd be very helpful. We are trying to add new material all the time.
Great, Victor. It's been a great pleasure.
Likewise. Thank you, Alex, for the invitation.